But are they alive? Chapter 13. There was another break after Mr. Crepsley and Madame Octa's act. I tried getting Steve to tell me more about who the man was, but his lips were sealed. All he said was, "I have to think about this." Then he closed his eyes, lowered his head, and thought hard. They were selling more cool stuff during the break. Beards like the bearded ladies, models of Hans Hans, and best of all, rubber spiders which looked like Madame Octa. I bought two, one for me and one for Annie. They weren't as good as the real thing, but they'd have to do. They were also selling candy webs. I bought six of those, using up the last of my money, and ate two while waiting for the next freak to come out. They tasted like candy floss. I stuck the second one over my lips and licked at it, the same way Mr. Crepsley had. The lights went down, and everybody settled back into their seats. Gerta Teeth was next up. She was a big woman with thick legs, thick arms, a thick neck, and a thick head.
"Ladies and gentlemen, I am Gerta Teeth," she said.
She sounded strict.
"I have the strongest teeth in the world. When I was a baby, my father put his fingers in my mouth, playing with me, and I bit two of them off."
A few people laughed, but she stopped them with a furious look.
"I am not a comedian,"
she snapped.
"If you laugh at me again, I will come down and bite your nose off."
That sounded quite funny, but nobody dared chuckle. She spoke very loudly. Every sentence was a shout and ended in an exclamation mark.
"Dentists all over the world have been astounded by my teeth," she said. "I have been examined in every major dental center, but nobody has been able to work out why they are so tough. I have been offered huge amounts of money to become a guinea pig, but I like travelling, and so I have refused."
She picked up four steel bars, each about 30 centimeters long, but different widths. She asked for volunteers, and four men went up on stage. She gave each of them a bar and said to try bending them. They did their best, but weren't able. When they had failed, she took the thinnest bar, put it in her mouth, and bit clean through it. She handed the two halves back to one of the men. He stared at them in shock, then put one end in his own mouth to check that it was real steel. His howls, when he almost cracked his teeth, proved that it was. Gerta did the same to the second and third bars, each of which was thicker than the first. When it came to the fourth, the thickest of the lot, she chewed it to pieces like a chocolate bar. Next, two of the blue-hooded assistants brought out a large radiator, and she bit holes in it. Then they gave her a bike, and she gnashed it up into a little ball, tires and all. I don't think there was anything in the world Gerta Teeth couldn't chew her way through if she set her mind to it. She called more volunteers up on stage. She gave one a sledgehammer and a large chisel, one a hammer and smaller chisel, and the other an electric saw. She lay flat on her back and put the large chisel in her mouth. She nodded at the first volunteer to swing the sledgehammer at the chisel. The man raised the sledgehammer high above his head and brought it down. I thought he was going to smash her face open, and so did lots of others, judging by the gasps and people covering their eyes with their hands. But Gerta was no fool. She swung out of the way, and the sledgehammer slammed into the floor. She sat up and spat the chisel out of her mouth.
"Ha!"
she snorted.
"How crazy do you think I am?"
One of the blue hoods came out and took the sledgehammer from the man.
"I only called you up to show the sledgehammer is real,"
she told him.
"No,"
she said to those of us in the audience.
"Watch."
She lay back again and stuck the chisel in her mouth. The blue hood waited a moment, then raised the sledgehammer high and swung it down faster and harder than the man had. It struck the top of the chisel, and there was a fierce noise. Gerta sat up. I expected to see teeth falling out of her mouth, but when she opened it and removed the chisel, there wasn't as much as a crack to be seen. She laughed and said,
"You thought I had bitten off more than I could chew!"
She let the second volunteer go to work, the one with the smaller hammer and chisel. She warned him to be careful of her gums, then let him position the chisel on her teeth and whack away at them. He nearly hammered his arm off, but he wasn't able to harm them. The third volunteer tried sawing them off with the electric saw. He ran the saw from one side of her mouth to the other, and sparks were flying everywhere, but when he put it down and the dust cleared, Goethe's teeth were as white, gleaming, and solid as ever. The twisting twins, Sive and Circe, came on after her. They were identical twins, and they were contortionists, like Alexander Ribbs. Their act involved twisting their bodies around each other so they looked like one person with two fronts instead of a back, or two upper bodies and no legs. They were skillful, and it was pretty interesting, but dull compared to the rest of the performers. When Sive and Circe were finished, Mr. Tall came out and thanked us for coming. I thought the freaks would come out again and line up in a row, but they didn't. Instead, Mr. Tall said we could buy more stuff at the back of the hall on our way out. He asked us to mention the show to our friends. Then he thanked us again for coming and said that the show was over. I was a bit disappointed that it had ended so weakly, but it was late and I suppose the freaks were tired. I got to my feet, picked up the stuff I'd bought, and turned to say something to Steve. He was looking behind me, up at the balcony, his eyes wide. I turned to see what he was looking at, and as I did, people behind us began to scream. When I looked up, I saw why. There was a huge snake up on the balcony, one of the longest I had ever seen, and it was sliding down one of the poles towards the people at the bottom. Chapter 14. The snake's tongue flicked in and out of its mouth, and it seemed mighty hungry. It wasn't very colourful, dark green with a few flecks of brighter colours here and there, but it looked deadly. The people beneath the balcony ran back towards their seats. They were screaming and dropping stuff as they ran. A few people fainted, and some fell and were crushed. Steve and me were lucky to be near the front. We were the smallest people in the theatre and would have been trampled to dust if we'd been caught in the rush. The snake was about to slither onto the floor when a strong light fixed itself to the snake's face. The reptile froze and stared into the light without blinking. People stopped running and the panic died down. Those who had fallen pulled themselves back to their feet and fortunately nobody appeared to be badly hurt. There was a sound behind us. I turned to look back at the stage. A boy was up there. He was about 14 or 15, very thin, with long yellowy-green hair. His eyes were oddly shaped, narrow like the snake's. He was dressed in a long white robe. The boy made a hissing noise and raised his arms above his head. The robe fell away, and everybody who was watching him let out a loud gasp of surprise. His body was covered in scales. From head to toe, he sparkled, green and gold and yellow and blue. He was wearing a pair of shorts, but nothing else. He turned around so we could see his back, and that was the same as the front, except a few shades darker. When he faced us again, he lay down on his belly and slid off the stage, just like a snake. It was then that I remembered the snake boy on the flyer and put two and two together. He stood when he reached the floor and walked towards the back of the theatre. I saw as he passed that he had strange hands and feet. His fingers and toes were joined to each other by thin sheets of skin. He looked a bit like that monster I saw in an old horror film, the one who lived in the Black Lagoon. He stopped a few metres away from the pillar and crouched down. The light which had been blinding the snake snapped off and it began to move again, sliding down the last stretch of pole. The boy made another hissing noise, and the snake paused. I recalled reading somewhere once that snakes can't hear, but can feel sounds. The snake boy shuffled a short bit to his left, then his right. The snake's head followed him, but didn't lunge. The boy crept closer to the snake until he was within its range. I expected it to strike and kill him, and I wanted to scream at him to run. But the snake boy knew what he was doing. When he was close enough, he reached out and tickled the snake beneath its chin with his odd webbed fingers. Then he bent forward and kissed it on the nose. The snake wrapped itself around the boy's neck. It coiled about him a couple of times, leaving its tail draped over his shoulder and down his back like a scarf. The boy stroked the snake and smiled. I thought he was going to walk through the crowd, letting the rest of us rub it, but he didn't. Instead, he walked over to the side of the theater, away from the path, to the door. He unwrapped the snake and put it down on the floor, then tickled it under its chin once more. The mouth opened wide this time, and I saw its fangs. The snake boy lay down on his back a short bit away from the snake, then began wriggling towards it. "No," I said softly to myself, "surely he's not gonna..." But yes, he stuck his head in the snake's wide-open mouth. The snake boy stayed inside the mouth for a few more seconds, then slowly eased out. He wrapped the snake about him once more, then rolled around and around until the snake covered him completely, except for his face. He managed to hop to his feet and grin. He looked like a rolled-up carpet.
"And that, ladies and gentlemen," said Mr. Tall from the stage behind us, "really is the end."
He smiled and leapt from the stage, vanishing in midair in a puff of smoke. When it cleared, I saw him by the back of the theater, holding the exit curtains open. The pretty ladies and mysterious blue-hooded people were standing to his left and right, their arms loaded with trays full of goodies. I was sorry I hadn't saved some of my money. Steve said nothing while we were waiting. I could tell from the serious look on his face that he was still thinking, and from past experience, I knew there was no point trying to talk to him. When Steve went into one of his moods, nothing could jolt him out of it. When the rows behind us had cleared out, we made our way to the back of the theater. I brought the stuff I'd bought with me. I also lugged Steve's gifts, because he was so wrapped up in his thoughts, he would have dropped them or left them behind. Mr. Tall was standing at the back, holding the curtains open, smiling at everyone. The smile widened when we approached.
"Well, boys," he said, "did you enjoy the show?"
"It was fabulous," I said.
"You weren't scared?"
he asked. "A little," I admitted, "but no more than anybody else." He laughed.
"You're a tough bear," he said.
There were people behind us, so we hurried on, not wanting to hold them up. Steve looked about when we entered the short corridor between the two sets of curtains, then leaned over and whispered in my ear,
"Go back by yourself."
"What?" I asked, stopping. The people who had been behind us were chatting with Mr. Tall, so there was no rush.
"You heard,"
he said.
"Why should I?"
I asked.
"'Cause I'm not coming," he said. "I'm staying. I don't know how things will turn out, but I have to stay. I'll follow you home later, after I've..."
His voice trailed off and he pulled me forward. We pushed past the second set of curtains and entered the corridor with the table, the one covered by the long black cloth. The people ahead of us had their backs to us. Steve looked over his shoulder to make sure nobody could see, then dived underneath the table and hid behind the cloth.
"Steve!"
I hissed, worried he was going to get us into trouble.
"Go on!"
he hissed back.
"But you can't..."
I began.
"Do what I say!"
he snapped.
"Go, quick, before we're caught!"
I didn't like it, but what else could I do? Steve sounded like he'd go ape if I didn't obey him. I'd seen Steve get into fierce rages before, and he wasn't someone you wanted to mess with when he was angry. I started walking, turned the corner, and began down the long corridor leading to the front door. I was walking slowly, thinking, and the people in front got further ahead. I glanced over my shoulder and saw there was still nobody behind me. And then I spotted the door. It was the one we'd stopped by on our way in, the one leading up to the balcony. I paused when I reached it and checked behind one last time. Nobody there. "Okay," I said to myself. "I'm staying. I don't know what Steve's up to, but he's my best friend. If he gets into trouble, I want to be there to help him out." Before I could change my mind, I opened the door, slipped through, shut it quickly behind me, and stood in the dark, my heart beating as fast as a mouse's. I stood there for ages, listening, while the last of the audience filed out. I could hear their murmurs as they discussed the show in hushed, frightened but excited tones. Then they were gone, and the place was quiet. I thought I'd be able to hear noises from inside the theatre, people cleaning up and fixing the chairs back in place. But the whole building was silent as a graveyard. I climbed the stairs. My eyes had got used to the dark, and I could see pretty well. The stairs were old and creaky, and I was half afraid they would snap under my feet and send me hurtling to my death. But they held. When I reached the top, I discovered I was standing in the middle of the balcony. It was very dusty and dirty up there, and cold too. I shivered as I crept down towards the front. I had a great view of the stage. The lights were still on, and I could see everything in perfect detail. Nobody was about, not the freaks, not the pretty ladies, not the blue hoods, not Steve. I sat back and waited. About 5 minutes later, I spotted a shadow creeping slowly towards the stage. It pulled itself up, then stood and walked to the center, where it stopped and turned around. It was Steve. He started towards the left wing, then stopped and set off towards the right. He stopped again. I could see him chewing on his nails, trying to decide which way to go. Then a voice came from high above his head.
"Are you looking for me?"
it asked. A figure swooped down onto the stage, its arms out to its sides, a long red cloak floating behind it like a pair of wings. Steve nearly jumped out of his skin when the figure hit the stage and rolled into a ball. I toppled backwards, terrified. When I rose to my knees again, the figure was standing, and I was able to make out its red clothes, orange hair, pale skin, and huge scar. Mr. Krepsley! Steve tried speaking, but his teeth were shaking too much.
"I saw you watching me," Mr. Krepsley said. "You gasped aloud when you first saw me. Why?"
"Because I know who you are,"
Steve stuttered, finding his voice.
"I am Laden Krepsley," the creepy-looking man said.
"No,"
Steve replied.
"I know who you really are."
"Oh?"
Mr. Krepsley smiled, but there was no humor in it.
"Tell me, little boy," he sneered. "Who am I, really?"
"Your real name is Verhorsten,"
Steve said, and Mr. Krepsley's jaw dropped in astonishment. And then Steve said something else, and my jaw dropped too.
"You're a vampire,"
he said. And the silence which followed was as long as it was terrifying. Chapter 15. Mr. Krepsley, or Verhorsten, if that was his real name, smiled.
"So," he said, "I have been discovered. I should not be surprised. It had to happen eventually. Tell me, boy, who sent you?"
"Nobody,"
Steve said. Mr. Krepsley frowned.
"Come, boy," he growled. "Do not play games. Who are you working for? Who put you onto me, and what do they want?"
"I'm not working for anybody," Steve insisted. "I've lots of books and magazines at home about vampires and monsters. There was a picture of you in one of them."
"A picture?"
Mr. Krepsley asked suspiciously.
"A painting," Steve replied. "It was done in 1903, in Paris. You were with a rich woman. The story said the two of you almost married, but she found out you were a vampire and dumped you."
Mr. Krepsley smiled.
"As good a reason as any. A friend thought she was inventing a fantastic story to make herself look better."
But it wasn't a story, was it? Steve asked.
No, Mr. Crepsley agreed. It was not.
He sighed and fixed Steve with a fierce gaze.
Though it might have been better for you if it had been, he boomed.
If I'd been in Steve's place, I would have fled as soon as he said that. But Steve didn't even blink.
You won't hurt me, he said.
Why not? Mr. Crepsley asked.
Because of my friend, Steve said. I told him all about you. And if anything happens to me, he'll tell the police.
They will not believe him, Mr. Crepsley snorted.
Probably not, Steve agreed. But if I turn up dead or go missing, they'll have to investigate. You wouldn't like that. Lots of police asking questions, coming here in the daytime.
Mr. Crepsley shook his head with disgust.
Children, he snarled. I hate children. What is it you want, money? Jewels? The right to publish my story?
I want to join you, Steve said.
I nearly fell off the balcony when I heard that.
Join him?
What do you mean?
Mr. Crepsley asked, as stunned as I was.
I want to become a vampire, Steve said. I want you to make me a vampire and teach me your ways.
You are crazy,
Mr. Crepsley roared.
No,
Steve said.
I'm not.
I cannot turn a child into a vampire,
Mr. Crepsley said.
I would be murdered by the vampire generals if I did.
What are vampire generals?
Steve asked.
Never you mind, Mr. Crepsley said. All you need to know is it cannot be done. We do not blood children. It creates too many problems.
So don't change me straight away, Steve said. That's okay. I don't mind waiting. I can be an apprentice. I know vampires often have assistants who are half-human, half-vampire. Let me be one. I'll work hard and prove myself, and when I'm old enough...
Mr. Crepsley stared at Steve and thought it over. He clicked his fingers while he was thinking, and a chair flew up onto the stage from the front row. He sat down on it and crossed his legs.
Why do you want to be a vampire? He asked. It is not much fun. We can only come out at night. Humans despise us. We have to sleep in dirty old places like this. We can never marry or have children or settle down. It is a horrible life.
I don't care,
Steve said stubbornly.
Is it because you want to live forever?
Mr. Crepsley asked.
If so, I must tell you, we do not. We live far longer than humans, but we die all the same, sooner or later.
I don't care, Steve said again. I want to come with you. I want to learn. I want to become a vampire.
What about your friends?
Mr. Crepsley asked.
You would not be able to see them again. You would have to leave school and home and never return. What about your parents? Would you not miss them?
Steve shook his head miserably and looked down at the floor.
My dad doesn't live with us, he said softly. I hardly ever see him. And my mum doesn't love me. She doesn't care what I do. She probably won't even notice I'm gone.
That is why you want to run away. Because your mother does not love you?
Partly, Steve said.
If you wait a few years, you will be old enough to leave by yourself,
Mr. Crepsley said.
I don't want to wait, Steve replied.
And your friends?
Mr. Crepsley asked again. He looked quite kind at the moment, though still a bit scary.
Would you miss the boy you came with tonight?
Darren?
Steve asked, then nodded.
Yes, I'll miss my friends, Darren especially, but it doesn't matter. I want to be a vampire more than I care about them, and if you don't accept me, I'll tell the police and become a vampire hunter when I grow up.
Mr. Crepsley didn't laugh. Instead, he nodded seriously.
You have thought this through?
He asked. Yes, Steve said.
You are certain it is what you want?
Yes, came the answer. Mr. Crepsley took a deep breath.
Come here, he said. I will have to test you first.
Steve stood beside Mr. Crepsley. His body blocked my view of the vampire, so I couldn't see what happened next. All I know is they spoke to each other very softly. Then there was a noise like a cat lapping up milk. I saw Steve's back shaking, and I thought he was going to fall over, but somehow he managed to stay upright. I can't even begin to tell you how frightened I was watching this. I wanted to leap to my feet and cry out, "No, Steve, stop!" But I was too scared to move, terrified that if Mr. Crepsley knew I was here, there would be nothing to stop him from killing and eating both me and Steve. All of a sudden, the vampire began coughing. He pushed Steve away from him and stumbled to his feet. To my horror, I saw his mouth was red, covered in blood, which he quickly spat out.
"What's wrong?"
Steve asked, rubbing his arm where he had fallen.
"You have bad blood!"
Mr. Crepsley screamed.
"What do you mean?"
Steve asked. His voice was trembling.
"You are evil!"
Mr. Crepsley shouted.
"I can taste the menace in your blood! You are savage!"
"That's a lie!"
Steve yelled.
"You take that back!"
Steve ran at Mr. Crepsley and tried to punch him, but the vampire knocked him to the floor with one hand.
"It is no good,"
he growled.
"Your blood is bad. You can never be a vampire."
"Why not?"
Steve asked. He'd started to cry.
"Because vampires are not the evil monsters of law,"
Mr. Crepsley said.
"We respect life. You have a killer's instincts, but we are not killers." "I will not make you a vampire,"
Mr. Crepsley insisted.
"You must forget about it. Go home and get on with your life."
"No!"
Steve screamed.
"I won't forget!"
He stumbled to his feet and pointed a shaking finger at the tall, ugly vampire.
"I'll get you for this!"
he promised.
"I don't care how long it takes. One day, Fur Horston, I'll track you down and kill you for rejecting me."
Steve jumped from the stage and ran towards the exit.
"One day!"
he called back over his shoulder, and I could hear him laughing as he ran, a crazy kind of laugh. Then he was gone, and I was alone with the vampire. Mr. Crepsley sat where he was for a long time, his head between his hands, spitting bits of blood out onto the stage. He wiped his teeth with his fingers, then with a large handkerchief.
"Children,"
he snorted aloud, then stood, still wiping his teeth, glanced one last time out over the chairs at the theatre. I ducked down low for fear he might spot me, then turned and walked back to the wings. I could see drops of blood dripping from his lips as he went. I stayed where I was for a long, long time. It was tough. I'd never been as scared as I was up there on the balcony. I wanted to rush out of the theatre as fast as my feet would carry me. But I stayed. I made myself wait until I was sure none of the freaks or helpers were about, then slowly crept back up the balcony, down the stairs, into the corridor, and finally out into the night. I stood outside the theatre for a few seconds, staring up at the moon, studying the trees, until I was sure there were no vampires lurking on any of the branches. Then, as quietly as I could, I raced for home. My home, not Steve's. I didn't want to be near Steve right then. I was almost as scared of Steve as I was of Mr. Crepsley. I mean, he wanted to be a vampire. What sort of lunatic actually wants to be a vampire?
End of Disc 2. Disc 3.
Chapter 16. I didn't ring Steve that Sunday. I told Mum and Dad we'd had a bit of an argument, and that was why I'd come home early. They weren't happy about it, especially my having walked home so late at night by myself. Dad said he was going to dock my pocket money and was grounding me for a month. I didn't argue. The way I saw it, I was getting off lightly. Imagine what they'd have done to me if they knew about the Cirque du Freak. Annie loved her presents. She gobbled the candy down quick and played with the spider for hours. She made me tell her all about the show. She wanted to know what every freak looked like and what they'd done. Her eyes went wide when I told her about the Wolfman and how he bit off a woman's arm.
"You're joking," she said. "That can't be true."
"It is," I vowed.
"Cross your heart?"
she asked. "Cross my heart."
"Swear on your eyes?"
"I swear on my eyes," I promised. "May rats gnaw them out if I'm telling a lie."
"Wow,"
she gasped.
"I wish I'd been there. If you ever go again, will you take me?"
"Sure," I said. "But I don't think the freak show comes here that often. They move about a lot." I didn't tell Annie about Mr. Crepsley being a vampire or Steve wanting to become one, but I thought about the two of them all day long. I wanted to ring Steve, but didn't know what to say. He would be bound to ask why I didn't go back to his place, and I didn't want to tell him that I'd stayed in the theatre and spied on him. Imagine, a real-life vampire. I used to believe they were real, but then my parents and teachers convinced me they weren't, so much for the wisdom of grown-ups. I wondered what vampires were really like, whether they could do everything the books and films said they could. I'd seen Mr. Crepsley make a chair fly, and I'd seen him swoop down from the roof of the theatre, and I'd seen him drink some of Steve's blood. What else could he do? Could he turn into a bat? Into smoke? Into a rat? Could you see him in a mirror? Would sunlight kill him? As much as I thought about Mr. Crepsley, I thought just as much about Madame Octa. I wished once again that I could buy one like her, one I could control. I could join a freak show if I had a spider like that and travel the world having marvelous adventures. Sunday came and went. I watched TV, helped Dad in the garden and Mum in the kitchen. Part of my punishment for coming home late by myself. Went for a long walk in the afternoon and daydreamed about vampires and spiders. Then it was Monday and time for school. I was nervous going in, not sure what I was going to say to Steve or what he might say to me. Also, I hadn't slept much over the weekend. It's hard to sleep when you've seen a real vampire. So I was tired and groggy. Steve was in the yard when I arrived, which was unusual. I normally got to school before him. He was standing apart from the rest of the kids waiting for me. I took a deep breath, then walked over and leaned against the wall beside him.
"Morning,"
I said.
"Morning,"
he replied. There were dark circles under his eyes, and I bet he'd slept even less than me the last couple of nights.
"Where did you get to after the show?"
he asked.
"I went home,"
I told him.
"Why?"
he asked, watching me carefully.
"It was dark outside, and I wasn't looking where I was going. I took a few wrong turns and got lost. By the time I found myself somewhere familiar, I was closer to home than to your house."
I made the lie sound as convincing as possible, and I could see him trying to figure out if it was the truth or not.
"You must have got into a lot of trouble,"
he said.
"Tell me about it,"
I groaned.
"No pocket money, grounded for a month, and Dad said I'm going to have to do loads of chores. Still,"
I said with a grin,
"it was worth it, right? I mean, was the Cirque du Freak superb or what?"
Steve studied me for one more moment, then decided I was telling the truth.
"Yeah,"
he said, returning my smile.
"It was great."
Tommy and Alan arrived, and we had to tell them everything. We were pretty good actors, Steve and me. You'd never have guessed that he'd spoken to a vampire on Friday, or that I had seen him. I could tell as the day wore on that things would never be quite the same between me and Steve. Even though he believed what I told him, part of him still doubted me. I caught him looking at me oddly from time to time, as though I was someone who had hurt him. For my part, I didn't want to get too close to him any longer. It scared me, what he'd said to Mr. Crepsley, and what the vampire had said to him. Steve was evil, according to Mr. Crepsley. It worried me. After all, Steve was prepared to become a vampire and kill people for their blood. How could I go on being friends with someone like that? We got chatting about Madame Octa later that afternoon.
Steve and me hadn't said much about Mr. Crepsley and his spider. We were afraid to talk about him in case we let something slip. But Tommy and Alan kept pestering us, and eventually we filled them in on the act.
How do you think he controlled the spider?
Tommy asked.
Maybe it was a fake spider,
Alan said.
It wasn't a fake, I snorted. None of the freaks were fake. That was why it was so brilliant. You could tell everything was real.
So how did he control it?
Tommy asked again.
Maybe the flute is magic, I said, or else Mr. Crepsley knows how to charm spiders the way Indians can charm snakes. But you said Mr. Tool controlled the spider as well, Alan said, when Mr. Crepsley had Madame Octa in his mouth.
Oh, yes, I forgot, I said.
Well, I guess that means they must have used magic flutes.
They didn't use magic flutes, Steve said. He'd been quiet most of the day, saying less than me about the show, but Steve never could resist hammering someone with facts.
So what did they use?
I asked.
Telepathy,
Steve answered.
Is that something to do with telephones?
Alan asked. Steve smiled, and Tommy and me laughed. Although I wasn't entirely sure what telepathy meant, I bet Tommy wasn't either.
Moron,
Tommy chuckled and punched Alan playfully.
Go on, Steve, I said. Tell him what it means.
Telepathy is when you can read somebody else's mind, Steve explained, or send them thoughts without speaking. That's how they controlled the spider, with their minds.
So what's with the flutes? I asked.
Either they're just for show, Steve said, or more likely, you need them to attract her attention.
You mean anyone could control her?
Tommy asked.
Anyone with a brain, yes, Steve said. Which counts you out, Alan, he added, but smiled to show he didn't mean it.
You wouldn't need magic flutes or special training or anything?
Tommy asked.
I wouldn't think so, Steve answered.
The talk moved on to something else after that. Football, I think. But I wasn't listening. Because all of a sudden, there was a new thought running through my mind, setting my brain on fire with ideas. I forgot about Steve and vampires and everything.
You mean anyone could control her? Anyone with a brain, yes. You wouldn't need magic flutes or special training or anything?
I wouldn't imagine so.
Tommy's and Steve's words kept bouncing through my mind over and over like a stuck CD.
Anyone could control her.
That anyone could be me.
If I could get my hands on Madame Octa and communicate with her, she could be my pet, and I could control her and...
No, it was foolish. Maybe I could control her, but I would never own her. She was Mr. Crepsley's, and there was no way in the world that he would part with her, not for money or jewels or... The answer hit me in a flash. A way to get her off him. A way to make her mine. Blackmail. If I threatened the vampire, I could say I'd set the police onto him, he'd have to let me keep her. But the thought of going face to face with Mr. Crepsley terrified me. I knew I couldn't do it. That left just one other option. I'd have to steal her.
Chapter 17. Early morning would be the best time to steal the spider. Having performed so late into the night, most members of the Cirque du Freak would probably sleep in until 8 or 9. I'd sneak into camp, find Madame Octa, grab her and run. If that wasn't possible, if the camp was active, I'd simply return home and forget about it. The difficult part was picking a day. Wednesday was ideal. The last show would have played the night before, so the circus would in all likelihood have pulled out before midday and moved on to its next venue before the vampire could awake and discover the theft. But what if they left town directly after the show, in the middle of the night? Then I'd miss my big chance. It had to be tomorrow, Tuesday. That meant Mr. Crepsley would have the whole of Tuesday night to search for his spider. For me. But that was the risk I'd just have to take. I went to bed a bit earlier than usual. I was tired and ready to fall asleep, but was so excited, I thought I wouldn't be able to. I kissed Mum goodnight and shook Dad's hand. They thought I was trying to win my pocket money back, but it was in case something happened to me at the theatre, and I never saw them again. I have a radio, which is also an alarm clock. and I set the alarm to 5 o'clock in the morning, then stuck my headphones on and plugged them into the radio. That way, I could wake up nice and early without waking anyone else. I fell asleep quicker than I expected and slept straight through till morning. If I had any dreams, I can't remember them. Next thing I knew, the alarm was sounding. I groaned, turned over, then sat up in bed, rubbing my eyes. I wasn't sure where I was for a few seconds or why I was awake so early. Then I remembered the spider and the plan and grinned happily. The grin didn't last long, because I realized the alarm wasn't coming through my headphones. I must have rolled over in my sleep and pulled the cord out. I leapt across my bed and slammed the alarm off, then sat in the early morning darkness, heart pounding, listening for noises. When I was sure my parents were still asleep, I slid out of bed and got dressed as quietly as I could. I went to the toilet and was about to flush when I thought of the noise it would make. I yanked my hand away from the lever and wiped the sweat from my brow. They would surely have heard that. A narrow escape. I'd have to be more careful when I got to the theatre. I slipped downstairs and let myself out. The sun was on its way up and it looked like it would be a bright day. I walked quickly and sang songs to pep me up. I was a bundle of nerves and almost turned back a dozen times. Once, I actually did turn and start walking home, but then I remembered the way the spider had hung from Mr. Krepsley's jaws and the tricks she had performed and swung around again. I can't explain why Madame Octa meant so much to me, or why I was placing my life in such peril to have her. Looking back, I'm no longer sure what drove me on. It was simply a dreadful need I couldn't ignore. The crumbling old building looked even creepier by day. I could see cracks running down the front, holes nibbled by rats and mice, spiderwebs in the windows. I shivered and hurried round to the rear. It was deserted. Empty old houses, junkyards, scrap heaps. There would be people moving about later in the day, but right then, it looked like a ghost town. I didn't even see a cat or a dog. As I'd thought, there were plenty of ways to get into the theatre. There were two doors and loads of windows to choose from. Several cars and vans were parked outside the building. I didn't spot any signs or pictures on them, but I was sure they belonged to the Cirque du Freak. It suddenly struck me that the freaks most probably slept in the vans. If Mr. Krepsley had a home in one of them, my plan was sunk. I snuck into the theatre, which felt even colder than it had been on Saturday night, and tiptoed down a long corridor, then another. It was like a maze back here, and I started worrying about finding my way out. Maybe I should go back and bring a ball of string so I could mark my way and... No, it was too late for that. If I left, I'd never have the guts to return. I'd just have to remember my steps as best I could and say a little prayer when it came time to leave. I saw no sign of any freaks, and began to think I was on a fool's errand, that they were all in the vans or in nearby hotels. I'd been searching for 20 minutes, and my legs felt heavy after so much walking. Maybe I should quit and forget the crazy plan. I was about to give up when I found a set of stairs leading down to a cellar. I paused at the top for ages, biting my lips, wondering if I should go down. I'd seen enough horror films to know this was the most likely spot for a vampire, but I'd also seen loads where the hero walked down to a similar cellar, only to be attacked, murdered, and chopped up into little pieces. Finally, I took a deep breath and started down. My shoes were making too much noise, so I eased them off and padded along in just my socks. I picked up loads of splinters, but was so nervous I didn't feel the pain. There was a huge cage near the bottom of the stairs. I edged over to it and looked through the bars. The wolfman was inside, lying on his back, asleep and snoring. He twitched and moaned as I watched. I jumped back from the cage. If he woke, his howls would bring the whole freak show down on me in seconds flat. As I was stumbling backwards, my foot hit something soft and slimy. I turned my head slowly and saw I was standing over the snake boy. He was stretched out on the floor, his snake wrapped around him, and his eyes were wide open. I don't know how I managed not to scream or faint, but somehow I kept quiet and stayed on my feet, and that saved me. Because even though the snake boy's eyes were open, he was fast asleep. I knew by the way he was breathing, deeply, heavily, in and out. I tried not to think about what would have happened if I'd fallen on him and the snake had woken them up. Enough was enough. I gave one last look around the dark cellar, promising myself I'd leave if I didn't spot the vampire. For a few seconds, I saw nothing and got ready to scram. But then, I noticed what might have been a large box near one of the walls. It might have been a large box, but it wasn't. I knew all too well what it really was. It was a coffin. I gulped, then walked carefully over to the coffin. It was about 2 meters long and 80 centimeters wide. The wood was dark and stained. Moss was growing in patches, and I could see a family of cockroaches in one of the corners. I'd love to say I was brave enough to lift the lid and peek inside, but of course I wasn't and didn't. Even the thought of touching the coffin gave me the shivers. I searched for Madame Octa's cage. I felt sure she wouldn't be far from her master, and right enough, there was the cage, on the floor, by the head of the coffin, covered by a big red cloth. I glanced inside to make sure, and there she was, her belly pulsing, her 8 legs twitching. She looked horrible and terrifying this close-up, and for a second, I thought about leaving her. All of a sudden, it seemed like a stupid idea, and the thought of touching her hairy legs or letting her anywhere near my face filled me with dread. But only a true coward would turn back now. So I picked up the cage and laid it in the middle of the cellar. The key was hanging from the lock, and one of the flutes was tied to the bars at the side. I took out the note I had written back home the night before. It was simple, but had taken me ages to write. I read it as I stuck it to the top of the coffin with a piece of gum. Mr. Crepsley, I know who and what you are. I have taken Madame Octa and am keeping her. Do not come looking for her. Do not come back to this town. If you do, I will tell everyone that you are a vampire and you will be hunted down and killed. I am not Steve. Steve knows nothing about this. I will take good care of the spider. Of course, I didn't sign it. Mentioning Steve probably wasn't a good idea. But I was sure the vampire would think of him anyway, so it was just as well to clear his name. With the note pinned in place, it was time to go. I picked up the cage and hurried up the stairs as fast as I could, being as silent as possible. I slipped my shoes back on and found my way out. It was easier than I'd imagined. The halls looked brighter after the dark of the cellar. When I got outside, I walked slowly round to the front of the theatre, then ran for home, stopping for nothing, leaving the theatre and the vampire and my fear far behind, leaving everything behind. Except for Madame Octa. Chapter 18. I made it back about 20 minutes before Mum and Dad got up. I hid the spider cage at the back of my wardrobe under a pile of clothes, leaving enough holes so Madame Octa could breathe. She should be safe there. Mum left the tidying of the room to me and hardly ever came in rooting around. I slipped into bed and pretended to be asleep. Dad called me at 8:15. I put on my school clothes and walked downstairs, yawning and stretching as though I'd only just woken. I ate breakfast quickly and hurried back upstairs to check on Madame Octa. She hadn't moved since I'd stolen her. I gave the cage a small shake, but she didn't budge. I would have liked to stay home and keep an eye on her, but that was impossible. Mum always knows when I fake being sick. She's too smart to be fooled. That day felt like a week. The seconds seemed to drag like hours, and even break and lunchtime went slowly. I tried playing football, but my heart wasn't in it. I couldn't concentrate in class and kept giving stupid answers, even to simple questions. Finally it ended, and I was able to rush home and up to my room. Madame Octa was in the same spot as earlier. I was half afraid she was dead, but I could see her breathing. Then it struck me. She was waiting to be fed. I'd seen spiders this way before. They could sit still for hours at a time, waiting for their next meal to come along. I wasn't sure what I should feed her, but I guessed it wasn't too different to what ordinary spiders ate. I hurried out into the garden, pausing only to snatch an empty jam jar from the kitchen. It didn't take long to collect a couple of dead flies, a few bugs, and a long, wriggly worm. Then back inside I raced, hiding the jam jar inside my T-shirt so Mum couldn't see it and start asking questions.
I closed my bedroom door and stuck a chair against it so nobody could come in, then placed Madame Octa's cage on my bed and removed the cloth. The spider squinted and crouched down lower at the sudden surge of light. I was about to open the door and throw the food in when I remembered I was dealing with a poisonous spider who could kill me with a couple of bites. I lifted the jar over the cage, picked out one of the live insects, and dropped it. It landed on its back, its feet twitched in the air, and then it managed to roll over onto its belly. It began crawling towards freedom, but didn't get far. As soon as it moved, Madame Octa pounced. One second she was standing still as a cocoon in the middle of the cage, the next she was over the insect, baring her fangs. She swallowed the bug down quick. It would have fed a normal spider for a day or two, but to Madame Octa, it was no more than a light snack. She made her way back to her original spot and looked at me as if to say, "Okay, that was nice. Now where's the main course?" I fed her the entire contents of the jar. The worm put up a good fight, twisting and turning madly, but she got her fangs into it and ripped it in half, then into quarters. She seemed to enjoy the worm the most. I had an idea, and fetched my diary from underneath my mattress. My diary is my most prized possession, and it's because I wrote everything down in it that I'm able to write this book. I remember most of the story anyway, but whenever I get stuck, all I have to do is open the diary and check the facts. I folded the diary open to the back page, then wrote down all that I knew about Madame Octa, what Mr. Krebsley had said about her in the show, the tricks she knew, the food she liked. I put one tick beside food she liked a lot, and two ticks beside food she loved, so far only the worm. This way, I'd be able to work out the best way to feed her, and what to give her as a treat when I wanted her to do a trick. I brought up some grub from the fridge next, cheese, ham, lettuce, and corned beef. She ate just about everything I gave her. It looked like I was going to be kept busy trying to feed this ugly lady. Tuesday night was horrible. I wondered what Mr. Krebsley would think when he woke and found his spider missing and a note in its place. Would he leave like I told him, or would he come looking for his pet? Maybe, since the two of them could speak with each other telepathically, he would be able to trace her here. I spent hours sitting up in bed, holding a cross to my chest. I wasn't sure if the cross would work or not. I know they work in the movies, but I remember talking to Steve once, and he said a cross was no good by itself. He said they only worked if the person using them was good.